You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Exactamente. You know, last week on our council segment, we had such good fun with Mark Fitchett, the pelagic fishery ecosystem scientist, that we decided to ask him back because one of the things that we got into, we were ostensibly going to be talking about yellowfin and big eye, mainly baby big eye, that they were looking for some core, some samples of tissue and stuff for an important study about DNA. And of course, working its way into conversation was my favorite fish, the marlin. And then I found out that not only is Mark interested in all the pelagics, but specifically one of the ones that I like to talk about the most. So marlin and spearfish. So this is round two. And Mark, first of all, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Thanks.
I got to get you your own parking stall. You need your own parking stall and I'll build it. Marlin are fascinating. And, you know, it's not just seeing the Cornelius Choi's 1,805-pound marlin that's a real thrill. But even a baby, when they start doing the jump and everything else, isn't that what gets most of us fishermen just lit up with just sheer joy when you got a marlin on the line?
Yeah, I mean, it's an adrenaline rush. Yeah. I remember when I was in grad school, not too long ago, in going down to Guatemala and in Costa Rica and catching these, you know, 400-pound marlin, putting tags on them, and even the small sailfish we were getting, you know, the 50-pound, 60-pound sailfish, those were a lot of fun to catch. Yeah. And it never got old, especially there when you're, you know, teasing them up on the surface and you're essentially are pitch baiting.
Yeah, you know, this is something that really rarely happens here. If you go down to San Diego, for instance, and you go on one of the long-range boats, that's kind of what you're going to see. And if you get into where Mark is talking about, they shouldn't call it fishing. They should call it catching, because when you go there, because of the geographics of the location or whatever, and the stocks there, you're going to get lit up. The minute you get to the ground, you're on fish.
There are lots of fish there. They're in high density because of the oceanographic features off of Central America, which could also work. One thing we're looking at here is, you know, there could be some similar features here in Hawaii that are serendipitous to billfish, and so which are very important for us to get a handle on.
What I'm really interested in, and I know that we're looking at feeding the world is a big challenge, and a lot of us, and especially at the council, that's what you guys are wrapped around all the time. How do we feed people, and how do we sustain a fishery? You would seem to think that the amount of fish that seems to be in those that part of the world that you're talking about, that why aren't they fishing them? Why aren't they feeding more people with those fish?
Well, one reason being is that those fisheries there are mainly small-scale fisheries in Central America and the Eastern Pacific.
Far away from the demand.
Yeah. Far away from demand. And also, you know, the stock, in general, catch rates throughout the entire basin have gone down.
Mm-hmm.
So there really hasn't been a stock assessment on sailfish. The stock may or may not be in as good a shape as just catch rates may indicate, because we're looking at catch rates in a very small part of the world, and this is off of Guatemala and off of Costa Rica, where you have a high density of fish, which is not to be confused with high abundance.
Yeah, and that's really interesting, because there are some places here on in the main islands in Hawaii where a certain fish might be very prevalent. You might be able to say at Barber's Point at one time there was a lot of kava kava there. Who knows why? But they were there. That you would think, well, they're everywhere. No, they're only there.
Yeah.
Isn't it sort of funny what habitat some of these animals prefer?
That's true. And they did fish, you know, they don't look at zip codes and boundaries.
Yeah, I should say.
They look at oceanographic features, ocean fronts, eddies, temperature breaks, things like that, especially where I was working in Central America, it's very pronounced. But here, it's the same story. I mean, these fish, you know, they're going to go where there's food, where there is opportunity for them to create, to spawn, and for their progeny to survive.
Yeah, you know, that's the other side of things. You sometimes don't think of those fish as having predators, but they do.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it? Sort of when you explain to somebody young, particularly, what a marlin's bill is for. What's that big long thing on their nose? What's that all about?
Well, the marlin bill is used to essentially corral, sort of like sort of like a matador corralling bait. And then also there's been video footage of them using it to stun. So they would essentially go in and hit the bait with their bait. Yeah, and you've seen the Troll Pro video of the teasers, right, at high speed. And the like a stripey will come up and just whack. And whack the camera, right, Troll Pro, which is really cool. And they use that to stun the bait, to slow it down so they can go in and eat it.
Well, that's the thing that you see. Every now and again, if you're trolling, here's a little tip. Every now and again, you get a knockdown. Let's say you have a stripey come up and it knocks, boom, your outrigger comes down and you zit, and then it's gone. What's happened is that that billfish has hit your lure with its bill and bust the rubber band, but it didn't get hooked. Sometimes it does get its bill wrapped, right? But this is not that. If you free spool that fish is going to come around probably and think, I did exactly what I wanted to do. I stunned this thing. Now look at it. It's flopping down there. I'm going to go eat it.
That could be the case. This is these folks here who are listening probably a lot more than I do about that. And I would agree that could be what's going on. That's why in Central America they use teasers and then they pitch bait. So you bring the teasers and so many fish, you can essentially
Bring them into the boat.
You can see it at the prop wash. Mm. I mean, people even throw flies at them. I know off Kona they've been able to do that too. They've been fly fishing they've been able to catch one on fly. I've actually got
there's not a bunch of world records are being caught on fly with some of our charter boats in Kona.
Yeah.
And certainly in places like Midway and other parts of the Pacific where they can catch big fish right offshore.
Well, and actually I'm jonesing to get one on fly. We'll be right before I moved. Well, just to tell you a story, right before I moved here to Hawaii, one of my a good friend of mine out in Asheville, North Carolina, who owns a fly shop, gave me as a gift. He gave me an Able and Sage a rod and reel set,
big game stuff.
with some plugs to go. He's like, you need to catch a marlin on fly while you are in Hawaii.
And by the way, the flies that they're talking about, they rival in size some of our trolling lures.
They're pretty gnarly. Big. So I need to practice my
your pitching.
But
what I'm saying is that. The interesting thing about it is it's a thrilling thing to catch, but also it's just they seem so abundant, and I don't know if that's a good word or not. And I want to move to that. Maybe you can explain. We got him, and he's the doc of the pelagics. How many different quote marlin species are in our waters ballpark?
So we have
big Pacific blue.
There's the Pacific blue. So we have what's called Istiophora. I'm not going to talk about swordfish,
right?
Because they're billfish, but they're different.
Right.
They're in a different family. We have Istiophora billfishes, which are your blue marlin,
right?
Your striped marlin. You get some which include your short bill spearfish,
right?
Not the same family. And then you also have sailfish.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally you get a black marlin here.
Right.
Occasionally they'll get some in some of the long line records. We've had some blacks. So you have roughly.
So that's like five.
Five. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is unique because not all places in the world have all those in the abundance that at least in the prevalence that we do here.
What sort of predators do they worry about?
Well,
I mean, obviously the big tigers. You know, or anything big.
There's not a whole lot of, at least for a big blue or a big blue or big black.
Big blue, few predators. Yeah,
there not a whole lot of things that are going to want to mess with him.
Yeah.
But what's funny is that McGrew Rice, who is one of our council, was a member of our council family.
That's his boat, by the way, is the Mighty Ihunui, which means big nose.
Yeah. McGrew is awesome. I've learned a lot from him just chatting with him and looking forward to talking more with him and getting to know him a little bit better. But one of the things he told me, because I'm really fascinated by short-billed spearfish.
Mm-hmm.
Having worked in Central America and sort of the enigmatic, mysterious nature of the species, I'm fascinated by them. Hawaii is one of the only few places where you can get them on a regular basis, sort of, right? You get them on a regular basis here. But one thing McGrew told me is that a strong short-billed spearfish bite precedes a big marlin bite.
Yeah, that's very, very true.
So,
I've seen that a number of times.
And I never even, as a biologist, you should be thinking about these type of things. But McGrew was like, they're eating them. The big marlin are eating
them. They come right up the back of them and eat them.
And they're eating chuckers, yeah.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is, let's depart for just 1 minute. This is a short bill, so why have it at all? I mean, what is its function? Same thing?
The same thing, presumably, but that's no, but there's the neat thing. That's why I'm so fascinated by them, is that we don't know very much about the reproductive biology, their aging growth. We have, there's been few tagging studies on them. We don't really know much about their migratory routes. We don't, all we have is catch data. And so, you know, getting some ideas on, you know, a lot of their biological characteristics and behaviors, tough. I can only surmise that they use their bill, their short bill, for the same reason that, let's say, a sailfish or a small marlin does.
I got something for you. But in the meantime, gang, remember, when you're talking about all this identification and stuff that we're talking about, you can go and download at wpcouncil.org some great charts, some great illustrations, and some great comparisons and great pictures, so you have an easier time when you are at sea to be able to identify what you got. And it really is simple. And a lot of this stuff is free, particularly if you're a teacher. You want to teach a class, there's some great materials at wpcouncil.org. Please avail yourself of them, because it'd be a great thing. Now, going back to this thing, what you said, it is amazing. If you go to the grounds like in Kona, every now and again you have a 5 pound aku or a shibi that you're using for bait, and a porpoise will come up behind it and take it from the gill plate back, never get on the hook. The same thing happens in reverse with the big marlin. If a big marlin comes up behind a short bill and grabs the whole thing, it's going to get caught. I don't know why, but it's going to get caught.
Yeah, I think it's probably a little bit of cognizance of knowing that. You know, that that bait, when that porpoise and when that marine mammal gets up to the bait, they probably notice that there's a little bit more jewelry hanging around, a little bit more hardware hanging around that fish, versus, let's say, a marlin, which is going to be, and its impulses is going to be just destroy it.
Yeah, but you know, that being said, I'm glad McGrew said that, and I agree with it. Also, that there are some people that know that for some reason they seem to be, the short nose, a little bit more playful. They knock down a lot of lures, but they don't get stuck on a lot of them. Same like a stripey. I'm sure you've heard that too. Stripey's all around the place, but I can't get them to hook up.
Yeah, they're pretty hard to hook up. Yeah. I mean, from personal experience, I got the fish with my buddy Jay Blunt down at Eva Beach, and you know, we've had two instances of a stripey coming up and hitting, and you know, pulling the hook. It's easy with these guys, with these fish. With the short-billed spearfish, you know, it could be the shape of the mouth, or it could be their general behavior, which makes them sort of elusive.
Here's a free plug, a free tip. If you suspect that one of these fish that you have is bill-wrapped, if it's giving you a lot of trouble because it keeps running back out on you, what you need to do is keep pressure on the fish. The minute you let up on your reeling, or take a slack, and if that fish turns towards the boat, if you're not retrieving your line, it's going to come unhooked, and you're going to lose it.
Huh.
Yeah, and if you keep the line taut, you're going to get it right up. But when you're getting ready to gaff that fish or to trap, whatever you're going to do to it, you only get one shot. And there's that horrible feeling when you can see the hook hooked onto the bill, and it comes off, and the fish goes right in front of your face. Okay, the value of the marlin to the fishery is pretty great. I know we're going through some consternation right now. What brought about the Marlin Act? And why are we being affected the way we are?
Well, to answer two parts of your question, you know, billfish are important recreationally, non-commercially for personal consumption. That's a distinguishment that here you have to make. There's non-commercial fisheries and there's recreational, but, you know, as I've been told.
So kind of a lot of gray areas here.
A lot of gray area, and I've been told by a lot of folks here is we don't play with our food. This is recreation.
That's it, right?
So. Which I respect, but you have some market value too in our longline fisheries because they are sold at auction. So, you know, there is value to these. Mm-hmm. There's a monetary, there's social, and then there's just personal food and nutrition. Now, the Billfish Act was brought about to prevent, due to the perception that billfish stocks
were dwindling.
In some parts of the world, they are. Mm-hmm. Stock assessments have shown that stocks are not doing too good.
Mm-hmm.
In parts, particularly parts of the Atlantic, some parts of the Pacific as well. And now, so, you know, the act was brought about to prevent the import, the bringing in billfish into the United States. From elsewhere, and which is, you know, on superficially is a noble act. And then originally Hawaii was exempt because mm-hmm. Hawaii, you know, we had some local a political will that, you know, really stood up for us to make sure that our folks here, it's their right, it's their culture, they need to be able to, or you know, harvest their fish.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times, gang, over the years I've said this. We owe an awful lot to Spark Matsunaga, to Dan Inouye, to a lot of our congressmen and women that have been, you know, protective of our fishery, and we had to continue to put pressure on them to make sure they stay there. That's just me, but it's true, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, and it's important.
And it's only so you know, and they get into, you know, the what happened is, so then a congressman and as mm. I how I perceive, mm. I was in Florida right before coming here to Hawaii mm. two years ago. A representative in Florida, in Central Florida, thought it would be a good idea to, you know, to get some of the ire of his constituents, right, mm-hmm. which are a lot of fishermen in Florida, right, would be to push this bill and to, quote, protect billfish and to really look after the stocks, which to me is just a bunch of malarkey.
Sure.
Because what this person, you know, also his campaign took, you know, money from Big Sugar Industry.
Yeah, by the way, we need to cover this for a minute because follow the money is what everybody says. And I think what happened was this guy had a twinge of consciousness and tried to do something to try to undo the wrong that some of his political contributors had done, and that was pollute the water with their sugar.
Yeah, that could have been issue too. And so, you know, and it's just whatever the case is, it's smoke and mirrors. It's a facade that was, you know, unfortunate. So, you know, in the end, it only hurts Hawaii. The fisheries in Hawaii barely, and our longline fisheries don't take many striped marlin. Mm. Our troll fisheries, local fisheries here, they don't put a dent in the overall stock. Comparatively to the rest of the our high seas international fleet. So if you really want to go after the problem, you're going after Hawaii is low hanging fruit that's not going to help the problem. And so at least from my perception and from a lot of folks here, that's how that's how people feel.
And interestingly enough, I've talked to chefs, purveyors, certainly the fishermen, and now the science. We're in pretty good shape, and I think that we're kind of self-regulating because some of these fish you got to travel far to catch, you know, and a lot of us aren't going out that far. But interestingly enough, I want to make sure we spend a minute on your personal personal you know, love of spearfish. Why spearfish? What fascinates you about spearfish?
Spearfish to me are interesting because having worked with a lot of fishermen in Costa Rica and Guatemala with a lot of the recreational fishermen there, it was kind of fascinating to me because they would occasionally run across these fish. Mm-hmm. And then looking at catch records from purse seine fisheries and longline fisheries, you would see, you know, in the Central Pacific, you'd start to see high catch rates just off the coast of Central America where a lot of fisheries were not, where a lot of fleets were not operating. And then you would see them go away. You would see the cyclical nature. And then you would hear in Hawaii, they have a run. A run.
Yeah, I remember them a lot.
And then, interestingly enough, you hear people here get runs of sailfish. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of work on sailfish. Mm-hmm. So I'm really interested to know what's driving the cyclical nature of catch rates here between the Eastern Pacific and here in Hawaii. You could be having maybe some movement of fish, perhaps. That's a possibility. Mm-hmm. That would not be unfounded, but maybe some environmental issues, like let's say current regimes running between the Eastern Pacific to Hawaii, El Nino. There's a lot of neat, really cool frontier research that can be done, I think, on this species. Also other species like Opla and Manchong or other plant species.
Yeah. And you know, that we do a whole nother show on that. Because of time constraints today, just a real quickie, what is the difference between a spearfish and a stripey?
That's a good question. Well, first, the obvious is the length of the bill relative when you see one is the length of the bill, but also the dorsal fin, the big, large sort of, they look like a short bill spearfish. I like to tell people it looks almost like a sailfish, but with the top of the sail cut off.
Exactly.
It's got a very long dorsal fin.
Yeah. Yeah, and the sailfish here, that when you do see them, they are fascinating.
They are.
And they put on quite a show, you know? Yeah. pretty interesting. All right. Well, you know, one of the other things, and real quickly, one more question, and that is, we have had cyclical concerns over mercury for many, many years, particularly attributable to the marlin, to the species. I mean, to the long noses. It seems like people say, well, you know, don't worry about it. Take selenium, take this and that. We haven't had a mercury scare for a while around here. That doesn't mean the threat of mercury has gone away, does it?
No, it doesn't necessarily mean it's gone away. You know, we had the similar issues with mercury and billfish in Central America because, you know, you have volcanoes, so you get a lot of mercury that comes in, a lot of seamounts.
Of course, we've had this volcano going off here for a long time, too,
some activities. Right? Yeah. So you're going to get some, as they call, species of mercury that can be that can be detrimental to health. There's also pollutants that precipitate from the air. From industrialized nations. So mercury is an issue. It's a global issue. You know, I really can't speak to the human health and human preventative measures, but it is something to at least consider.
But I got to tell you, you'd have to eat an awful lot of fish to die of mercury poisoning.
You'd have to eat a lot of them.
Yeah, sometimes pretty scary.
You would.
Well, listen, you know, now that we know, we're going to get together. We got to get together again real soon in this year. On two of the other pelagics that we touched upon before, last time you and I were together, and that are Munchong and Opa.
And they're delicious.
Yeah, they are, and we love them. Thanks, Mark. And that's if you want to see what other things done by Dr. Mark Fitchett and the others are at the council, go to wpconsul.org. wpconsul.org. Have a specific good rest of your weekend. Thanks for being with us. And remember, if you want to hear something on Go Fish, particularly in this segment, drop me a line. TheMikeBuckShow@gmail.com. TheMikeBuckShow@gmail.com. Tight lines, following seat. Sharp hooks, big bites. See you next time. Aloha.